So we've got these triples. There is a graph that there is a topic of graph databases, and there is a graph database called Neo4j, which presumably you could use with RDF. I'd be astonished if you couldn't. So we can apply concepts from logic to talk about RDF, and we can apply concepts from graph theory to talk about RDF. Now, when we've got the subject and predicate and object, what actually do they look like? There are actually three things. Subjects and predicates and objects can all be, I want to say, URLs. The definition actually talks about arrays. Now, a URL is a specification, is a special case of a URI, and a URI is basically an ASCII. Arrays, internationalized resource indicators, can use Unicode characters. So there's a technical issue there which is largely irrelevant. We'll come back to this. But the key thing here is we've got this way of naming things. I mentioned it before, that the names that we use for subjects, predicates, and objects live in namespaces. They are scoped by domain names or other rules appropriate to the appropriate area. So that there's, if we take reasonable care, if we talk about barns, there's no confusion with somebody else talking about barns, and we might be using an English dialect or a language in which a barn is a farm building, and they might be using an English dialect or another language in which barn is a word for child. So how many barns do you have? Well, in that sense, I have no barns. In that sense, I have two. We really do want to keep these things separate. And, you know, there are only so many common names to go around for things. There are all sorts of esoteric relationships we could talk about. But even take little things like, let's take the concept brother. Now, in English, brother is a simple concept. Your brother, well, if we don't, your full brother is somebody who's not you, who's male, and has the same parents as you. A half brother is somebody who has one parent in common with you, is male, and is not you. And a stepbrother and so on, we can define them. So brother actually starts to get a bit fuzzy and ambiguous when you push on it, but it's basically same sex, same generation. So same sex is me, different sex. If my daughters had a brother, it would be different sex. I was getting muddled up with the next thing I was going to say. Some languages don't have a brother word. They've got one word that means a sibling of the same sex, and they've got a different word meaning a sibling of a different sex. So if X male in English, X and Y would both call Z their sister. In some of these languages, X would call Z my opposite sex sibling, and Y would call her my same sex sibling. In yet other languages, you would split either sibling or brother and sister or same sex and opposite. You would split them into two different words for older sibling and younger sibling. So somebody coming from this, if we hear that X is, if we hear that, if we say that Y is, if Z is Y's sister, we think we've been totally unambiguous. somebody coming from another language would say, but I can't tell from what you just said whether Y is male or female. And I can't tell whether Y is older or younger than Z. Why are you being so vague? And going in the other direction, okay, there is the Catholics assert that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was not only a virgin when she conceived Jesus, but remained virgin all her life. And Protestants say, but hey, the New Testament talks about Jesus' brothers and sisters, his Adelphoi. To which the Catholics retort, you idiot, don't you know that Adelphos in Greek at the time meant male of the same generation in your family and covered cousins as well as brothers? To which the Protestants say, well, yeah, it could mean that, but... And there the matter rests. So, Adelphoi, were Jesus' Adelphoi his brothers or his cousins? Well, we can't tell. Whoever wrote that sentence thought they were being clear and unambiguous. So when, if even such a simple thing as the concept brother can be differently analysed in different cultures, we'd better, if we want to have a brother relationship in a database, it had better be scoped to something which clearly defines its semantics. Okay. I mean, this is why, I mean... there's the old philosophical thing. First, define your terms. And there's a good reason and a bad reason for that. The good reason for insisting that people define the terms that they're arguing about is to make sure that they're arguing about the same thing. The bad reason is why Socrates did it. Socrates was a proto-totalitarian who was out to show that nobody was fit to rule except possibly somebody like him. And so he would demand definitions. He would say, you over there repairing that sandal, if you can't define sandal and shoe so that they can be clearly distinguished from everything else in the world, then you're not even fit to tell me what a shoe is, let alone have a voice in the government. Okay. That's the bad thing. But we can have this thing where there is ambiguity and we didn't realise it. I've just been talking to the 3G6 students about their attitudes and saying, okay, there were problems there with assignments where they didn't not attitudes where they didn't actually know, they didn't get correctly. It wasn't that they weren't producing the right answer, but that they were answering the wrong question. This is pervasive. And I bet you, if you look at one of these things on the web, one of these vocabularies out there on the web, if you poke hard on it, it will turn out to be a bit fuzzier than you think. I think there's an ultimate limit on how well we can use logic on macro domains over large groups of people. Because I think it's going to be hard to get agreement on what these things mean. And I think it's going, one of the reasons it's going to be hard to get agreement is that people will think they agree when they don't. So the fact that these things are scoped is important. Subjects and objects can be blank nodes. I will explain what that means shortly, but it's very simple. It's a node that doesn't have a label on it, so that we can't refer to it except through the things it's in relationship with. The object of a fact can also be literals. So we can have something like size 42. Okay. So literals, when you draw them as graphs, don't have a circle around them. They're not things. Now, I'm going to, if I don't run over time, I'm going to criticize Sparkle at the end. And I'm going to indirectly criticize RDF. So what's this? Eri, for the most part, they're just strings in namespaces. But some namespaces have defining documents that say what these things mean. RDF itself comes with some things. FOV, friend of a friend. It's a thing, this is a vocabulary for talking about social networks. There's a schema.org that's mentioned in this as well. Now, the important thing here, by the way, is that there's a technical term in logic, rigid designator. Let's take a phrase like the Queen of England. At the moment, that's Queen Elizabeth II. Now, Queen Elizabeth II is a rigid designator. When she is dead and gone, there may be another Queen of England. Queen Elizabeth II will still refer to the same person, but the Queen of England won't. And we can even, some philosophers love to toss around examples like, this is one of the current ones, one of the favourite ones, the present King of France is bald. Is that true or false? There are worlds where it's true, there are worlds where it's false, and there are worlds where it doesn't make sense because there isn't any present King of France. So the present King of France is not a rigid designator. It doesn't designate the same person in all worlds. A rigid designator is a name that always stands for the same thing. So we can, when we talk about one of the key things about something like the web, definitely whether possible worlds are anything other than a theoretical construct is anybody's guess. But we do know that there are different times. So, I mean, okay, I should have said something like the Prime Minister of New Zealand. But hey, I like Her Majesty. And I don't like John Key. But of course, the Prime Minister of New Zealand happens to be John Key at the moment. There was a time when he wasn't the Prime Minister, somebody else was. And there will be a time when he isn't. May it be soon. So this is one important thing about the way you're supposed to think about these IRIs. They are rigid designators. They always stand for the same thing. What happens if you've got something that changes? Well, you might say, NZ. You might use something like that to stand for the person who is Prime Minister of New Zealand in 2014. And this might or might not be the same person as somebody else. Okay. You would have to, if you've got something that can change, you have to build some sort of versioning scheme into the name of it. Now, IRIs, when we talk about URLs, the things we mainly think of are HTTP, HTTPS, FTP. Okay, these are things that you can fetch over the web. But then, of course, there are also things like, and mail to URLs are sometimes used to refer to people. Although they aren't rigid designators either. Okay. This semester there is a mail account in this department called Mark 326 for the students to send email to, and I'm in. next semester. I don't know whether we'll keep that and share the workout with somebody else. There might be two people that can access that account. The next one after that, there might be somebody different again doing it. So that should probably really get some sort of versioning, but it doesn't. People commonly treat mailboxes as unique ways of referring to people. But just because people are representing something some way in RDF doesn't mean that it's right. This thing about, is it a rigid designator? This is one of the things you need to bear in mind if you ever find yourself using logical data on the web. Am I naming things or versions of things? There is an ISB, there, what is it? There's DOI, Document Identifier. Okay. You often see document identifier numbers as references to applications. And unfortunately, your browser cannot navigate to those and fetch them. Hey, so, blank nodes. Blank nodes are basically existentially quantified variables. In a particular collection of facts, what we're saying is that there is some nameable thing which is related in various ways to other things, but that we happen not to have a name for it. Now, the notation that people use is an underscore, then a colon, and then this thing called a local name. This is just like the variable name that you write after an exists sign. It has, within a particular collection of facts, every reference to a blank node with the same local name will refer to the same blank node. And here's an example. There is an M. Sorry, I've got the colon in the wrong place there, haven't I? I'm sorry. I must fix that. This is... Let's fix that now. Oh, I was right to be. So when I'm opening up a set of slides written using Apple's Keynote, what's actually showing it is preview, so it won't let me change anything. Okay. Imagine that I've got the colon and the M the right way around. So this says there is an M, which is the mother of Bart Simpson, and her hair colour is blue. We can say that without having to have a name like Simpson's colon March. Actually, she's probably the nicest character in the whole of The Simpsons, and I include the episode where she became a vampire. So the thing about this, it is exactly an existential quantifier. So what we've got is existential conjunctive data. All of there exist variables, there exist values for variables making all of these facts true. It's a big and with a bunch of exists outside. There are the three special prefixes that have some semantics that are always relevant to RDF. That should be RDF schema, not RDF scheme. RDF is used for some things that were invented for RDF, and the big ones here are how we begin to bring in some description logic. RDFS is used for RDF schema, which brings in more description logic. This comes from XSD, comes from XML schema, and lets us give data types for literals. Okay, and so if we wanted to refer to this property type of the element in description logic, we should use this URL. There's a much more recent version of RDF. It's RDF 1.1 now, but this URL is frozen. We wouldn't write that in full. We're not mad. We would write RDF colon type. So this prefix RDF colon stands for everything up to and including the sharp. And this illustrates a common naming technique where you use a URL with a fragment identifier. The URL without the fragment identifier defines the whole vocabulary, and the fragment identifier points to the definition of this particular thing. Now, values in general are strings annotated with a type. Y, up arrow, y, carry, I'm not particularly sure. There's a whole bunch of them. They're mostly in the XML schema standard, and they're things like just plain old string, Boolean decimal, integer. These are unbounded decimals, unbounded integers. Doubles and floats are IEEE numbers. Date and time, date timestamp. This one has to have a time zone. This one doesn't. G, year, month, and day, and so on are for recurring dates. Then we've got C, like data types, byte, short, long, and so on. We can say something as a string that represents a binary object in base 64. We can refer to a human language. We can just have an identifier, these things here. And there are two special things introduced by RDF itself. One says this string is HTML, and one says this string is XML. Now, in fact, there's a choice here. Do I have that on the next slide? No. Let me just say this briefly. Literals can have a type or a language, but not both. So we could have tag things with a language like that. That's barn tagged with EN, and that's barn tagged with NO. There is an RDF defined type called lang string, which is for this. If you have a string without anything, it's just an XSD string, it's just a plain old string. Also, if you want a value of type Boolean or decimal or integer, you can just write it without any quotation marks. But I'm getting a bit ahead of myself here. Next one. So, what have we got here? It's all plain RDF is just triples. We've got blank nodes, and blank nodes are existentially quantified. Blank nodes are not different in kind from other nodes. It's just that we've got names that are globally meaningful for other nodes, and we've only got local names for blank nodes. But we've got names. What have we got? We've got binary relations between entities, and binary relations between entities and values. And given that, the only logic that comes in is two sets of triples are equivalent if we can relabel the blank nodes to make them the same. That's all the logic and inference there is in just that. That doesn't mean that the problem of dealing with triples is an easy one. There is a programming language called Prolog. There is an implementation of Prolog called SWI Prolog, and SWI Prolog comes with a toolkit for RDF called Cleopatria, which seems to mean fatherland history, but never mind. And in the documentation, for SWI Prolog, it says, if you want to store more than 10 million triples in memory, you'd better be using the 64-bit version of SWI Prolog. So they're talking about storing millions of triples in memory. And there is, that's in a 10 million triples in a 32-bit machine. Not bad going. There was a few years ago, and I believe it's been met, the billion triple challenge. Demonstrate that your triple store will work with 1,000 million triples in it. So we're talking about simple reasoning on very large amounts of data. Plain RDF. That's just plain RDF. RDF schema adds a few things, and this makes it a description logic. So we've got this built-in predicate called type. And so we're saying C is a class. This defines C as a concept. By the way, RDF class, RDF type, RDF class, and RDF type is, we can declare a property. RDF type is an RDF property. It's all sort of tied in neat knots. So we can say here is a concept, here is a role, a binary predicate. Here is an individual that belongs to a concept. And we've got subclass, which is just containment. We've got subproperty of, which is contained on binary relations. And we've got domain and range. Now, I've written it this way, to indicate that domain is still in ELC, but we can also declare ranges, which is outside the scope of ELC as such. What RDF schema doesn't add, and this is important, it doesn't add any rules to the T-box. Okay? The only things we can't... We can say that certain things are subclasses, but that's all. And these things are not compound concepts. You cannot form compound concepts in RDF. So we don't have empty. So we can't do negation. We can't say, you know, pet and person is contained in empty. We just can't do that. So it is a description logic. It's a very weak description logic. But even that is enough to push up the complexity of querying it. Okay. Because subclass of is transitive and property of is transitive. Subproperty of. So suppose we've got C1 contained in C2, and I'm just doing this as a description logic. So we do have these inclusion rules from which we can compute the transitive closure. So given one fact about an individual, that can imply n facts about that individual. So in this particular query, C1, C2, C3, up to CN are all answers for that query. So if we took, for that matter, if find the Q such that P is contained in Q, there's order n squared. And so the complexity of the number of solutions to a query can obviously be at least quadratic in the size of the database, which is, if you're talking about 1,000 million tuples, that's not good here. But at least it's polynomial. Okay, this is all decidable. It's decidable using fairly simple algorithms, and these simple algorithms scale about as well as anything can, because when you've got transitive connections like that, there can simply be a polynomial number of answers. Okay, next one. I'll press the wrong key. By the way, why do we have this difference between RDF and RDFS? If you look carefully here, this is RDF, this is RDF, this is RDF, 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 this is RDFS, this is RDFS, this is RDFS. The official definition is, it's a somewhat annoying historical artifact which has preserved the backwards compatibility, which is to say, we got it wrong, so we have to keep it wrong forever. Now, there are... Let me just flick over to schema.org to show you what's there. Oh, why are you wasting my time? No, I don't want it to be the default browser. So schema.org is a collection of schemas that you can use to mark up things in ways recognized by major search providers and can be used for structured data interoperability. And many sites are generated from structured data. When it's formatted, it becomes difficult to reconstruct it. A shared markup vocabulary makes it easier for webmasters to decide on a schema and get the maximum benefit, so we can all talk the same language. Okay, so if we go a bit schemas, you can navigate this, but you've got things like event, health and medical types, organization, person, place, restaurant, product review, action, book, movie, all sorts of stuff. And if we go over to list of types. So we've got, they just added some new ones, but we've got thing, action, turning scroll bar is supposed to be scroll, and turning scroll bar. So you've got a whole lot of different kinds of actions. So you say somebody creates something, somebody cooks something, somebody draws something, somebody fills something. Something, find, check, etc. All kinds of things here. If I had been feeling really mean for the assignment, I'd have got you to describe a day in your life using these things. But this goes on. You can see we've been scrolling and scrolling, and we're still here's where the bubble is. So people in the web community have already agreed on ways to refer to lots of things and relationships between them. I've already mentioned FOT, friend of a friend. That's in this as well. That's in this. So this is one of the reasons why it matters to you that RDF exists and that RDF schema exists and that there are these things out there. People are hammering away, trying to come up with shared vocabularies. You need to know that these things exist. Now, how do we write RDF? Well, there are many things called RDF. RDF is basically just an abstract data type, a set of triples, where triples are these abstract things. But there are lots of ways of turning them into text. The first thing to be defined was XML. There is a way of embedding RDF in HTML, and you can even produce RDF as JSON. I could go on about this. I could rave about the complexity of the XML version. Once you've got the basic idea, you can pick up any one of these that you need. Strictly speaking, if you're actually using any of this stuff in a program, what you want to do is to just use an existing library to read the stuff. There's enough fiddly bits in the syntax that you really don't want to fuss with it too much. The simplest method of all is called n-triples. By the way, you may still find references to something called N3 or notation 3. As far as I can see, it's pretty much dead. But the 3 refers to the triples. So here's what you do. You write the subject and some white space and your predicate and some white space and your object and some white space and a full stop. Or you can write your subject, your predicate, and a literal. And IRIs are written between angle brackets. One of the reasons for writing IRIs between angle brackets is that I could be wrong about this, but I believe that IRIs allow embedded spaces where URIs and URLs do not. So you need some way of saying this space is separating space and this space is not. So that's it. You can write any set of triples this way, except that's really not going to get you blank notes. The one that pays off the most to know, I believe, is Turtle. Practically anything that can deal with RDF can deal with Turtle, and Turtle is the starting point for Sparkle, the query language. So the first thing is that these URIs, or IRIs, sorry, get ridiculously long. In fact, IRIs generally are ridiculously long. It's a pain in the you-know-what to be repeating them over and over. So we could say things like base HTTP / politics. We could say something like that, and then we could use PM, and this URI would be interpreted relative to that base URI, just like href, relative names in an HTML page. So that gives us a lot of abbreviation. But there's another thing too. We can use this prefix business. We can declare a prefix and an identifier followed by a colon, and we can say that that stands for something. So we could say prefix pol something. And conventionally, it's usual to, but it's not invariable, you would want this prefix to end with either a sharp or a slash. And what happens when you define a prefix, an identifier preceded by that prefix is read by popping down a pair of angle brackets, dropping in what the prefix was defined as, and then dropping in the name. And there's a special case of this, the prefix can be empty. So when people are writing a particular little database, they will commonly use just a plain colon as the prefix for things in that file. And they'll use a named prefix for things outside that file. We can abbreviate if we've got several triples with the same subject. Instead of using full stop, we can use a semicolon. So we can write subject, predicate 1, object 1, semicolon, predicate 2, object 2. And the semicolon repeats the subject. If we've got a bunch of triples with the same subject and predicate, using commas in the predicate part lets us repeat the subject and the predicate. And there's a special hack that RDF type can be abbreviated to A. And this works even if you don't have RDF defined to be anything. It's not saying A is replaced by the string. It says A is replaced by what this normally stands for. So, here's an example. Why did I have capital space in the previous slide and @ like as space in this slide? I'll get to it in a minute. So here we define a base. Here we define a bunch of prefixes. These are the actual prefixes. This example is adapted from the RDF documentation. And so here we're defining something in Wikidata. We're defining an entity, http www.wikidata.org entity Q12418, and it's got two triples for it. We've got DC Terms title is the literal Mona Lisa, and DC Terms creator is, and here's a reference to DBpedia, Leonardo da Vinci. What's DC Terms? This was probably the first standard vocabulary. The Dublin Core for Metadata. You've got some information about a document like when was it published, who wrote it, who authorised its publication, all that kind of stuff. There's this core of 12 terms. I actually proposed in one of the Erlang conferences that they should be used for annotating Erlang source files. The talk was well received, but the idea was not never adopted. So one of the things that they've got in the Dublin Core is author. Now, author is another one of these rather fuzzy concepts. If I've got a book in my office whose author is said to be the mathematician Brouwer, B-R-O-U-W-E-R. What actually happened was he taught a course and somebody took very detailed notes. And after Brouwer died, they wrote up the notes and turned it into a book. But since the ideas weren't there, it was credited to Brouwer. Who is the author? I've just been reading a book by an ancient Near Eastern archaeology. And the question is asked, you've got this letter. Say, His Majesty says. Is that what the king said? Or did the scribe put it into polite terms? Who is the author? If these are the verbatim words, then the fact that the king said it and the scribe wrote it doesn't mean that this guy isn't the author, that the king is the author. But if the king said something and the scribe wrote something else, and the king said, yeah, that's okay, then isn't the scribe the author? If an American president gives a speech and a speechwriter wrote, who exactly is the author? For example, is anybody here a Muslim? But I can say this. There's a collection of Muslim traditions from the lifetime of, gathered after the Prophet died to settle some thorny points. They're called the Hadith. Now, one of them has that Muhammad was dictating one of the surahs of the Quran one day, and the scribe wrote down something different from what Muhammad had said. And when he read it back, he said, oh dear, that's not what you said. I'd better tear this up and write it again. And Muhammad said, oh no, what you've got there is better than what I had. But what Muhammad was supposed to be saying was, Muhammad was supposed to be reciting the verbatim word of God. And here he's saying that the scribe had something better than what God had said. At that point, that scribe lost his faith. Who was the author? Yeah. So it's just like brother. The question of the word author is a bit fuzzy. If you've got something and this really matters for copyright. Oh, there was this lovely case. Lovely case recently. There's a blog called Lowering the Bar, which is about law. And there was this guy visiting Indonesia, and he had his camera, and he left his camera out, and the monkeys came along, and they took a whole lot of pictures, including a number of selfies. And so various people had liked this, and they put up some of the pictures on the web. And a certain publisher that the English guy had assigned his copyright to said, cease and desist, you'd better take these down, we own the copyright. And the question is, if you've got a photograph taken by a monkey, who owns the copyright? Who, if anybody, is the originating author? Can a monkey pressing buttons because they make a lovely clicking noise be said to be the author, the creator, of the photograph? And the answer seems to be that nobody owns the copyright, because if anybody was the creator, it was the monkey, but copyright holders can't be non-human beings. I mean, they can be humans or human-owned businesses, but they can't be monkeys. But, you know, is the monkey the author? Is the monkey an author if he didn't mean to take a picture? These things leak if you push hard on them. So let's go on to the next slide here, because this shows us two triples with the same subject. Biblical terms define things like creator. You might, for some application, need a different definition of creator. Here we've got a relative URI. So Bob, sharp me, where that is a person using the friend of a friend vocabulary, and knows Alice, and has a birth date of such and such date with an annotation here of a type, and this person is interested in that version of the Mona Lisa. Here we've got a full URI, and here we've got something quite interesting. Square brackets in a turtle description refer to blank notes. You can refer to a blank note by giving it a local name, or you can just put some description of it between brackets. So in here, this says, there is something which is interested in something called the Mona Lisa, which was created by Leonardo da Vinci. Okay. Every time you've got a pair of square brackets, you've got a new blank node, and inside the square brackets, you've got predicate object, predicate object, predicate object. Okay. So the thing about turtle is that as long as you keep your eyes, as long as you keep your names tolerably short, it's much easier to read than any of the other notations. Also, it's easy to generate, in particular, N triples are a special case of turtle. If you've got N triples data and you've got a turtle parser, the turtle parser can read the N triples data. So turtle is a good thing to work with. What's a triple store? A triple store is a thing that accepts these triples and stores them, possibly in memory, possibly on disk, possibly on some mixture of them. And it lets you enumerate matches. Now, in SWI Prolog, you load a file
and then you can refer to things. So this is a partial match. That was not meant to be capital letter. That was meant to be a lowercase letter, sorry. We've got constants and we've got variables. Now, when you've got subject, predicate, and object, there are three things. Each of them could be a constant or a variable. In a pattern, we were saying, find me the matches for this. There are three places that could be variables. That gives us eight combinations. We can ask, is this a fact? At the other extreme, we could say, tell me all the tuples, all the triples. And of course, the thing about this is some queries are going to give you lots of answers. They're going to take a long time. But some queries don't have many answers. You'd like the cost of answering a query to be roughly proportional to the number of answers you get. So in particular, if I say something like, here is a predicate and an object. So, who is Bart Simpson's mother? I'd like it to come back with an answer pretty quickly, assuming that it's got that little example I had before. I'd like it to come back pretty quickly because Bart Simpson only has one mother in the database. There should be an index which is up to the task of saying, we know these two bits, find me the third, or find me all the things that match the third, in time roughly proportional to the number of answers. So the issues that we have to consider when we're dealing with triple stores are, first of all, just how space efficient is this? Now, the range I have seen for a given collection of facts, the amount of memory used varies by a factor of 50 between different triple stores. I keep on mentioning SWI Prolog because it has one of the best triple stores around, as far as in-memory ones are concerned. It is, when it comes to the memory requirements for view triples, SWI is at the bottom of the space cost. It's pretty good at speed of loading, and it's really quite good at speed of retrieval. It allows us every kind of match. But there's one more thing. There's one more thing that you worry about. RDF is not just about saying, here is some information. It's about integrating them. And so you want a triple store to be able to hold multiple graphs and to issue queries where some of the information comes from one graph, which would have come from one website, and some of the information comes from another graph, another website. Now, I'm actually not going to talk about how you say any of that in the rest of this lecture. There just isn't time. What am I hoping from this lecture? I want you to go away remembering RDF is triples. RDF now is literals, but not as subtext. RDF schema is a weak description logic. A triple store holds triples, and from Spark on, we can query things in certain ways. And when you see Sparkle, you're going to say, well, that's pretty obvious, except where it's complicated. But I must say that for practical purposes, I would not use Sparkle. I would use Prolog. Because Prolog is a simpler, cleaner, and more powerful language. And SWR Prolog is darn good at it. What about inference? With these things like RDF type and RDF estimate, we've got this description logic. We would like a query to succeed if it's true whether the triple that we're matching was explicitly present there or inferred. So some triple stores can do inference, some can't. Things that do inference are, of course, more complicated.
But even that takes us only so far. I said at the beginning of this that one of the reasons for having description objects was to distinguish between stuff that was fairly simple that we could do in a weak but complete logic, you know, complete within its limits. We could get sound inferences. And then we could have something that was more expensive or more complicated or more expensive on top of that. And this is what happens with RDF. We've got our basic RDF. We've got the inferences that are licensed by RDF schema. But we'd like to do more complicated things than that. We don't just want to say, give me all the triples that match that. We'd like to get information from two triples and put them together. We'd like to be able to say not who is Bart Simpson's mother, but we'd like to be able to say what is the colour of Bart Simpson's mother's hair. And that requires a join, an and. So RDF has the RDF layer, which is a description logic layer, and it's got something other than that on top. And that other thing is called Sparkle, and I can't remember the derivation of the acronym. The RQL at the end are RDF query language, and the S at the beginning is Sparkle. It's a recursive acronym. Okay, here's how you get Sparkle. You take Turtle. You introduce logical variables. They're identified by a leading question mark, which is why I've been using question marks. And they can stand for either entities, nodes, that is, or literal values. You add a bunch of keywords. You say, SQL, everybody knows SQL, everybody loves SQL. SQL is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. SQL is God. Please, can I look like you when I grow up? And then you stir it back a bit. Okay. Sparkle looks embarrassingly like SQL. Why do I say embarrassing? Because SQL stinks as a language, it really does. And I'm going to show an example where Sparkle makes life difficult. So the basic query is, we've got a bunch of variables, select variables where, and here is a bunch of triples, we're saying find all the ways of filling in values for these variables that make these triples match in the database. Now here's a problem. Suppose we've got A, B, C, A, B, D, and I do select. I'm sorry for the people who are listening to this recording. My machine is just running out of power, and I didn't bring the cable. It's fully charged. Thank you.
Hello, I'd like to make an appointment for my daughter Abigail O'Keefe sometime tomorrow afternoon. 65 Mornington Road. Sometime after, say, 2:30. I don't think so. If you tell me your name, I might be able to remember if Abigail's... I think Abigail would prefer to see a woman, but there was one woman that she had some trouble with. Triggered an anxiety attack. About a month or two? It was somebody we hadn't seen before, I can tell you that, but... Yes? Okay. 2:45. Okay, bye.
It's 4 o'clock.
I'll give it a bloody rest. Give me 5 minutes now. I'm in the middle of updating something. Wait in the seminar room. Cool. I'll join you there. is that doing? It's recording again. I want that to stop.